Most people are familiar with jigsaw puzzles. You know the kind. The puzzles that you can buy that come in a box. They have a picture on the front of that box, and that's really the image of the puzzle, that when it's all assembled, it's going to look like that picture. The complexity of jigsaw puzzles really kind of hinge on three factors. One is the coloration of the picture. You know, if the coloration of the picture that is on the front of the box is real subtle, you know, no real bright colors, it's kind of subtle in terms of grays and shades of blues and pinks and things of that sort. So it's really not obvious where to place any one piece of that puzzle, then it becomes a little bit more complex. The size and shapes of those puzzle pieces, sometimes if they're very, very big, of course, it's going to be a lot easier. That's what a puzzle would be for a child. But for adults, the size and shape of those things, when they're all basically the same, then it becomes more complex. It's not obvious where the corners are or where the edge of the picture is because of the way those things are shaped. That makes it more complicated. The third thing is the number of pieces that make up the game. So, say you have a puzzle that's 250 pieces, that's going to take a shorter amount of time, all things being equal, other than the number of pieces, than a 500-piece puzzle. And a 500-piece puzzle would take a shorter amount of time than, say, a 1,000-piece puzzle. Simply because of the complexity of it, the number of pieces, all the decisions that have to be made. What goes where? Where does this belong? Now, the manufacturer of jigsaw puzzles, I assume, is something like this. They are a picture that is glued to, say, a sheet of sturdy cardboard, and that sheet is then cut into pieces by using a real sharp mold that is pressed down into it, so the mold has knife edges that cut the pieces into however many pieces that puzzle is designed to have. Depending on the shape, depending on the arrangement of knives on the mold that are going to be pressed into that cardboard, that determines the size and shape of each of those pieces of the puzzle. Now, you can imagine that the knife's got to be really sharp and the pressure's got to be really great so that every piece of the puzzle is going to have nice, clean edges that are going to withstand somebody handling them, picking them up, putting them there, picking them up, putting them down, and so on as they try to make a decision as to where those pieces go. And if the pieces had rough edges, then all of a sudden they become frayed. You know, the picture may separate from the cardboard. You know, then become a little bit more difficult to see what it is. And then, because the handling is not conducive to them maintaining their shape, because, the edges were ragged, then the pieces don't fit together. And so making the puzzle harder to assemble because of these pieces are ill-fitting and harder to see what the image is because the paper is starting to peel off and so on. So not only is it harder to assemble the puzzle, but it's less fun too. There's a difference between an idea of a puzzle and the idea of a mystery. In a mystery, some pieces are missing. Pieces in a puzzle are all present. So if we have a mystery, we're looking at the pieces and we would consider them to be clues. That's really how it's looked upon. Pieces of a mystery are called clues. In a puzzle, because all the pieces are present, the challenge of a puzzle is that the order or the arrangement of those pieces, how they fit together, how they belong together, is not yet known. And so that's the trial and error, just does it fit, does it fit, does it fit, does it fit here, where does it go, sort of thing. Now, the title of this talk is not Solving the Mystery of Life, mainly because I don't think life is a mystery. I think all the pieces, all the clues are already present, so that makes it not a mystery. That makes it more like a puzzle. And I'm thinking like a 1,000-piece puzzle, was going to take more time than a 250-piece puzzle or a 500-piece puzzle, we've got to devote sufficient time to the assembly process of this really complex puzzle. So the title of my talk today is Putting the Puzzle Together. How much time is going to be necessary? I don't know. That's an individual decision, but I think it makes sense to decide that you have 120 years and healthy years in order to assemble the puzzle. That's the number I've chosen minimum to live, and so you know I've got a lot of time for assembly, trial and error. Unlike a jigsaw puzzle with a static, unchanging picture that's glued on the front of that cardboard, you know, when you see it in the box in Toys R Us or some other store, Walmart or Target or somewhere, those pictures stay the same, and the pieces of the puzzle are nice and clean cut into neat little pieces. But the human puzzle is different. We have a picture, that is our identity, and that's largely unknown. You know, we could say, oh, I'm a boy, that's one element of a picture. Oh, I'm a girl, that's another element of a picture. But we're constantly changing from the moment of conception right on up to our final breath. This image that is us is changing. Our pieces are not cleanly cut either, with sharp edges. Instead of that being shaped precisely and premeditatedly by machinery, I think our pieces are formed more likely by rough handling, and then it's combined with our own sensitivity or our own fragility. You know, how fragile do we think we are? How tender do we think we are? How brittle do we think we are? And if that's however we see ourselves in those areas, is essentially going to be a factor in establishing what kind of puzzle we are. I think we can look at it like this, and it's analogous to having a beautiful red heart-shaped glass tray. I happen to have one because it was a gift. It's about the size of a human heart, but so it's not really a tray. It's a piece of art, piece of glass art. But it's similar, the formation of the human puzzle is similar to this glass heart being dropped on a hard floor. And you can imagine, it's going to shatter into many pieces. So, what size and shape pieces? I'm thinking these fragments are all kinds of sizes and shapes. The diversity is going to be enormous. Some of them are going to be little splinters, and others are going to be larger chunks. So, that's how the human puzzle is formed in a lot of cases, by mishandling of others or by our own perceptions of being mishandled. And because of this mishandling, the picture of who we are, that is our identity, that is this picture on the front kind of idea, how we present ourselves to other people, becomes harder for us to see. The pain involved, whether it's emotional or mental or physical or all of the above, that accompanies that crash of the heart and as it breaks into pieces, causes us to try to understand, because we're meaning givers. I think that's one of the real defining characteristics of humankind, is we try to give meaning. We want to understand what caused the pain so that we might avoid it in the future. One obvious image is when a child puts his or her hand on a hot stove, right? Here's an experience. They put the hand on a hot stove. That child is going to quickly learn to keep the hand off the hot stove because the hot stove is to blame for the pain that that child feels in its hand. That's obvious, right? What's not so obvious is this, is that the child, that child's inquisitiveness, that child's inquisitiveness, the idea that children need to touch because it's physically intelligent and that's how it gains information, or the hand, or perhaps the fact that the child didn't follow instructions, perhaps it was being headstrong, perhaps it was being disobedient, being reckless, etc., could all be blamed for the pain. So now the child, in moments of pain like the scenario describes, can attach meaning and causation to the pain. And adults often volunteer in the unkindest of ways identity-defining inputs that they add to the picture, that this is going to be now superimposed over the identity of that child. You can imagine there were screams from parents that said, "You stupid child! What's wrong with you? You never listen. You have done it. Now you've done it. Wait until somebody gets home. You're bad. Get out of the kitchen and stay out." And on and on and worse and worse. These inputs are commands. Every one of them. They're not a report. They're a command. And they penetrate the child's awareness and create the sense of identity, the picture that is related to this puzzle, this child trying to figure out who and what it is. Because in pain, that's when we're most vulnerable. Not just children, but adults as well. When we're in shocked pain, we are very vulnerable to being programmed by other things being said in our environment. Now, as an aside, I want to talk about what might really have happened. Kids explore. It's part of human nature to do that. And I think it's probably true of even other animal forms, like little puppies or kittens. They want to explore. They touch things. And this is why we think that childproofing a house makes so much more sense and is so much kinder and better for a child's development, rather than walking around near a child and for about a million times during its first few years of life yelling, "No, don't touch that. No, don't touch that. No, don't touch that." Telling a child not to touch something doesn't teach a child valuable lessons. Except maybe you could help them understand what's going to happen if they touch a hot stove. That could actually be taught without touching the hot stove, and just a declaration of "don't do it" is insufficient information to most children. Like a wet paint sign, right? Those signs proverbially induce somebody to go, "Is it really wet? Let me touch it." As compared to actually keeping people away from touching that paint. The horrible things that a parent can say at a time like that, and this to me is reality, is not really about the child touching the hot stove. It is due to that self-rejection in the parent, because the parent failed in one of its most fundamental roles as a parent, and that is to protect its child. When a parent fails to do that, there is a knowingness that goes along with that, and there is a blame and there is a pain, mentally and emotionally and physically, to that parent for having failed. And then that rush of self-hatred in the parent, about the parent, explodes. And guess what? It explodes onto the child. So the child goes from being not protected to now being abused by being caught in this torrent of self-hatred that the parent is spilling on it. And in a case like this, more fragments of that child's heart go skittering across the floor. I often talk about the convenient 10 emotional states as a way to identify where we happen to be processing information. And these two ways are basically this. I talk about these 10 emotional states as if they were a 10 rung ladder. Depending on which rung of the ladder we happen to be standing on, what space emotionally we're standing in, our view of ourselves, of life, of God, of opportunity, of other people, are different. And so as we move up these rungs, or down these rungs, starting at the bottom, shame, then above that apathy, then above that grief, then above that fear, above that lust, above that anger, above that pride, and then the top three are courageousness, acceptance, and peace. SAG, S-A-G, FLAP, F-L-A-P, CAP, C-A-P. This is a convenient model. So when you're listening to people, it becomes pretty easy after a little bit of practice to identify what rung of the ladder those folks are standing on because of the way they're talking, the way they're acting. And you can also do the same thing for yourself. You'll know, based upon your own thought processes, including that internal self-talk, or what you're speaking, or how you're acting, which rung of the ladder you happen to be standing on. The second way I tend to describe the 10 emotional states is if they were a walkway of 10 tiles or 10 steps out in the garden, for instance. When we're going to undertake a new project, I think it's inevitable that we're going to touch each of these steps somewhere along the line. And depending on what we're trying to do, whether it's, oh, I want to learn how to balance a checkbook or bake a cake or windsurfing or a new language or anything else, a new project, a new job, a new activity, that we're going to take the first step into shame. We're going to step on that stone and we're going to have feelings of shame. Why didn't I do this before? And what's wrong with me? And I'm defective and I should have done this when I was younger, and on and on and on. And then we can take one more step if we recognize that, instead of fighting where we are, hop up to apathy. Now, that doesn't sound like much of a bargain, but to go from shame to apathy is, in fact, an improvement. But apathy is where you find depression or hopelessness or despair. Now, that doesn't sound like a treat, but it's starting to lighten us up. And then we jump up to grief. Still doesn't sound like any bargain. Grief is about loss and not having stuff that we wanted or should have had or could have had or would have had or so on. And then we hop up to fear, where this is a concern about loss. And then lust, where we crave something. Gotta have it, gotta have it. It's the only way to be happy and healthy and you name it. And then we move up to anger, and then pride, and then courageousness. And ideally, continue on up to acceptance and peace. So if we understand that we're going to be stepping on these stones, then we don't spend any time beating ourselves up when we happen to be standing on them. We become aware of it and hop up to the next one. So our outlook, our view of life, ourselves, God, opportunity, the challenge ahead of us, all changes for the better. So today I want to use a third image to describe how these emotional states could play an important part in our roles as we see them in our lives and in the formation of the puzzle that is us. Think of a high stone, concrete, cement steps. You've seen something like this, right? You maybe leading up to some monument in Washington or in New York City, they had steps like this outside the main public library on Fifth Avenue. This whole series of steps. But instead of a lot of steps, we're talking about 10 large steps. You know, the kind that a child would struggle because of the height of the step. It would be difficult for that child to lift its leg and maintain its balance as it tried to climb up those steps, standing, not on all fours, but in fact standing. Got the image, right? So now let's just add something to it. This is the idea that this child is holding this delicate, beautiful heart in its hands as it's trying to mount these steps. It's trying to maintain its balance. It's trying to protect itself. It's trying to protect this heart that is delicate and could be hurt if it were to trip and fall. All the time looking around for affirmation, that is, looking for attention or approval or guidance or some other source of information that would tell it how to navigate up these difficult steps as it's making its way to the top. The height of that makes that maintaining the balance difficult for that child. It is inevitable that that child, us for instance, are going to trip and fall and have our heart shattered on the step. And the first step is labeled shame. We do this by tripping and falling. We do this by comparing ourselves to others. We do this by listening to the identity-forming commands or screams or comments of people around us. We pick ourselves up. We pick up the larger pieces of this heart that has been broken, and we continue our climb. And it's inevitable that we will trip and fall and break our heart even more on the next step, labeled apathy. As we continue this climb, just picking up the bigger pieces, leaving little pieces behind, that we're going to develop skill at maintaining our balance, but we're going to continue to trip and fall and break off more pieces of our heart. And the tripping and the falling and the breaking continue. The construction, the rearrangement, the deconstruction, the reconstruction of our image of who and what we are continues through that entire process. We may have started out thinking we were whole, but as we progress, we become less whole, more fragmented, more fractured. And the picture of who we are and what we are and how we are keeps shifting. All of this keeps shifting and adjusting according to the meanings that we assign to what just happened and the meanings we allow others to assign to those life events. Go back to that kitchen scene where people around us are screaming horrible things. You know, we're not being helped by those kind of labels, those kind of identity-forming stamps. At some point in our lives, I think we're going to arrive at the awareness that we should go back to each of the steps of shame, apathy, grief, fear, lust, anger, pride, courageousness, acceptance, and peace. And I would suggest that we would want to start at the lowest level, shame, and pick up the pieces of our hearts so we can assemble the puzzle that is us with the picture that we choose now in 2011 or 2012, whenever you're hearing this, so that we can construct this identity now that we have a lot more experience than we did when we were little children, having these experiences for the very first time. We can choose the image that we want on the puzzle, and then we can become it. Instead of being labeled as we've been labeled as children, you're this, you're that, you're this, you're that, we're becoming. We're never going to be permanently anything one way or another, because we're continually growing, we're continually evolving, we're continually expanding in awareness of who and what we are. And so we can add the thoughts we want, the feelings that we want to that image, and that can make these pieces of the puzzle from all the steps come back together and fit together. I think we can return to those times and places in our memories. We can review them, we can think them, we can recall them, and retrieve the pieces of us that we blamed for the pain, not only the pain that we experienced during those trips and falls, but the pain that we believed that we caused other people to experience. At some point, we're going to come to the conclusion that we didn't cause other people those pains. The way they processed information, the way they assigned meanings to events, is what caused the pains. But by lovingly looking at the hurt and the damaged pieces, I think they become visible to us, almost as if they're willing to come out of hiding in the corners of our minds, if you will, almost like we've dropped stuff on the floor and now we're looking for it and looking for it. The more open we are, the more receptive we are, the more loving and kind we are, the better our vision becomes. And now those things come out of hiding because it's almost like there's a sense that there's no risk of more pain being delivered to the part or the part causing pain for the person looking for them. By knowing the words that we might have labeled some of these pieces as they broke off from our heart, or the words that may have been used in the labeling of them by other people, can give us an opportunity to address those parts by name using those words and invite them out so they can return to being part of the whole, so they can be part of a healed heart. So as an example, let me just describe this question as it relates to shame, and this is just one example. What did we do that if other people knew about it would bring disgrace? Dishonor. Condemnation. And the list goes on and on that I've compiled of words that would describe this emotional state of shame. And I've done the same thing for apathy and grief, fear, lust, anger, pride, courageousness, acceptance, and peace too. Shame oftentimes just thinks of, that's just one word, and it's kind of like stress. It bounces off us. It doesn't really have any specific image connected to it. But when you start looking at words like disgrace and dishonor and condemnation and others, then all of a sudden, images of those pieces can become available to us. And the pieces of our heart that we feel contain these energies are being hidden from us, by us. We're pushing them away, wrongly thinking that if I can push them away, then I won't experience the pain, I won't feel bad about myself, and I can create a better picture. I don't think that's true. There are going to be huge gaps in our self-image that cause us to be timid because we're going to be trying to hide it. We'll become reclusive. Or because of the anxiety and bad feelings that causes in us, we're going to be judgmental of others or worse. You know, if I were to take the idea of a mosaic up on a wall, and you could see that there are many pieces missing, so much so it's hard to identify exactly what is that? Same with us as the puzzle. We need to have all of our pieces reclaimed, retrieved, called back, and accepted into the whole. You can't be whole without being whole. We need to have all of us brought back. And I think that becoming whole requires, in one way, a lot of courage. A lot of courage for us to look at and accept that we're always expanding our awareness and to becoming more effective at putting our ever-changing puzzle together. And as children, very small children, our effectiveness is the level of effectiveness of children with children's awareness. When we were 3 and 4 and 5 and so on, we were not rocket scientists. We were not highly evolved in the physical world. And if we become aware and compassionate about that and don't have judgments that we were bad because we put our hand on a hot stove or tripped or fell, then all of a sudden our ability to become whole, because we had the courage enough to welcome back these parts labeled one way or another in such a way as we thought we'd be better off if we kept them away. Takes courage, takes compassion, it takes a sense of love, ultimately we have to arrive at this conclusion. Love heals, not rejection, not punishment, not diminishing us or others. Love heals, welcoming all of us back into one piece makes us whole. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from letter 8 in the book Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we're sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.